know how we do it.
Welcome. You are now in the village.
What up, y'all? This is your girl, Lady Jay. What up, y'all? This is your girl, Lady Jay. Y'all know what to do with us, huh?
You are now in the village, home of Taking It Back Tuesdays. Welcome to the village, the kids' corner, the second helping, and music moments.
It's your girl, Lady Jane. Recording from the bedroom, from the kitchen table, from the library there. You know how we do it.
This is KK. This is KK. This is KK, and you're listening to Bluntly KK.
Welcome to the Village, it's your man KJ with this week's show of Welcome to the Village. And, of course, I have Lady J. How you doing, baby?
Hey, baby.
That's right. And we have a special guest, Lady J.
Yes, we do have a special guest. And we have Miss Camila Brown here. Camila is an advocate in the education world. And I just thought it would be interesting to bring her in to the table and bring her to Welcome to the Village to begin to have a conversation about education and advocacy. And, you know, there are things that happen in the education system that us as parents don't know about, and we don't have the education to know about because we believe that, you know, our children are being taught by teachers, and the teachers have our best interests, our child's best interest at heart. And sometimes that's not the case. So, you know, in having conversation with Camila off the air, I wanted to kind of bring it to the table and just, you know, start. This is where we start having, you know, learning about stuff and learning about issues that are a problem.
Dialoguing.
Yeah, that we may not even know that it's a problem. You know, sometimes you don't know you have a problem until somebody tells you you got a problem. Like, that's how infomercials work. Am I saying this right?
Infomercial.
Okay, that word.
Take the New York out of your mouth.
Look, I'm just saying, like, that's how this works, because, like, you'll be sitting there watching TV and you realize, like, the commercial for a Snuggie comes on. And you're thinking, I didn't even know I needed one of those. But all of a sudden, you have a burning desire to buy a Snuggie, you know? So this is going to be our Snuggie conversation right here, you know? Like, you didn't know that you had an issue until Welcome to the Village brought it to the table.
And that is at Loving Chanel, if y'all want to hit her up and discuss this further with her.
I don't care. I ain't scared. I ain't even scared, you know? I'm just saying, for real.
Hey, it's her birthday. She's allowed.
That's true.
That's right.
Happy birthday, man.
That's right. Happy birthday, baby.
It's your birthday. Oh, sorry.
Okay, I'm sorry. All right. We're getting the look. I'm sorry.
No, we're good. Trust me, I let it go.
I get the look all the time. I just ignore it. Like, you can't be looking at me.
I know. She's looking angelic today. Angelic. Very angelic.
Thank you.
Got her fancy dress on. Get it, baby.
Oh, for you. It's all for you.
Oh, okay. I'll take that. But so let's jump into this.
Okay.
Camila, let's talk about your background as an educator. Let's jump into that first. I want to know, like, where'd you get your start and what's your passion about as far as education goes?
Okay, so ironically, education found me along the way. Okay. I actually went to school for communications, public relations. Mm-hmm. And I got out of college, and I went to Dominguez Hills. I got out of college, and subbing was what I did, you know, to supplement income, as most people do. And I started in Compton Unified, and
really?
I did. at a school called Caldwell Elementary.
I know.
Amazing teachers there. They just took me under their wings, and I had a second grade class, and I ended up having a long-term job. So I was basically their teacher. And I fell in love with it. Like, it was, you know, people say you know something is meant for you when it's the thing that you do that requires the least effort. Mm-hmm. Like, it just flows out of you. And quite honestly, had they paid me or not, I would have still done it.
That's what's up.
And those kids, it was a second grade class, like I said, I just loved it. And I continued and I fought. And the way the laws at the time to get your credential were structured, I was fighting going back to school. Because, you know, once you get out of college, you don't, the last you thing don't you want to do is go
You don't
want to
go
school.
Back, that's for sure.
I fought it for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, you know, you had to jump through hoops to get your credential.
Oh, okay.
So I applied to a small liberal arts college in L.A., Mount St. Mary's College. It's okay. Now Mount St. Mary's University in downtown L.A. And I went into debt. But, hey, I got my multiple subject credential, mm-hmm. my master's, and then a few years later, my special ed credential. And through that journey, I worked and I worked at JPL, I worked at a women's shelter, all of this while going to school, getting my credential in the evening. It took me 4 years. But that took me to LA Unified.
Mm-hmm.
And I encountered more amazing teachers that were mentors of mine, that took me under their wing.
Mm-hmm.
And I started at a school called John Mack Elementary down the street from USC. And I taught fifth grade. And this year, my class is graduating high school.
Aww.
All those kids in that class are
wow.
graduating high school. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's full circle moment, if
yes.
you will.
Yes.
And so fast forward to I've been teaching. I left, as you all aware, in about 07, 08, when the market and the recession, everything just blew up. The education in department in the U.S. basically, but in California just was hemorrhaging money. Like, they were getting cut left and right. And so 2 years into this dream job, my job was cut.
Oh.
And with 1,600 of us, we were just laid off with
oh,
no recourse.
Wow.
1 day before we were to become permanent.
Oh, wow.
So the solution was to make
I'm sorry, I was just thinking, that's janky.
Yeah.
You know, that's like
it was rough. And, you know, but legally they had to let us know that March. So you kind of, you had to continue with your passion knowing that you weren't going to be able to, not knowing what was
yeah.
next.
Mm-hmm.
And so being that we were, I don't know if you all know this, but anywhere in California, I'm not sure when you go outside of California, but when you start in a new district, you are considered probationary for 2 years. Up to 2 years. So for 2 years, you know how you have any other job, you're on 90 days probation,
mm-hmm.
30. Well, in teaching is 2 years.
Mm.
And during those 2 years, you have to do, if you just are getting your credential, you have to do a program called BITSA.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody that is listening to this cringes when they hear BITSA. It's an acronym. Beginning Teachers something. That's how much it's, you know,
yes.
it's
yes.
not
the bane
like,
of
just
your like existence.
The bane
yes.
of your existence. But basically, it's doing your teacher program all over again during your first 2 years as a teacher.
In every, so like, let me make sure I clarify this. So if you started off in the LA County School District and then you came down here to the San Diego and started teaching, you would have to do BITSA all over again?
So you have to do it when you get a new credential. So when you first get your credential, it's not permanent. It's called preliminary.
Okay.
And then you have, I think, 5 to 6 years before you can make it clear or permanent.
Mm-hmm.
And so during those 5 or 6 years, you it's federal. The county actually gets federal funding, which funnels into the districts to provide all of this beginning teacher support.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's basically a duplicate of what you just did in your teacher prep program. They're coming in and monitoring you.
Mm-hmm.
They're videotaping your lessons. You're working with, you're identifying certain students. You're working with one-on-one. You're doing lessons with. You know, you go into classes in the evening after you teach. And if you're in your first year of teaching and then you have to do this as well, it can be overwhelming.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
So you have to do this for the 2 years. You can get it on an accelerated program if you have previous teaching experience. But again, like you said earlier, that's something most people don't know about the accelerated until you knee deep in it. And so around the time when we were laid off, you couldn't even complete BITSA unless you were in a teaching position, but we were laid off. So how were we going to do BITSA and get our credentials permanent? Well, they made us substitutes. So we were in classrooms and as regular teachers, but we had substitute classification. So that meant you went from, let's say, L on the pay scale down to A.
Yeah.
But you were still functioning as an
a regular everyday teacher,
but you were a substitute. Right. So I did that for 3 years. I was at the same school, Hyde Park, which is now Yes Academy off Crenshaw and Slauson. And I, it was very hard, but very rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
It was a high crime neighborhood, you know. The socioeconomics were most of the kids, the whole school qualified for free lunch. Mm-hmm. So my first class, you know, they'd gone through several subs and every kid in the class was identified as below basic or far below basic.
Wow.
So here I am, you know, coming from, got my credential and did my first 2 years and then I got laid off and now this is the class I get. And I will be honest to tell you, my first month, I had to go to urgent care and get on EKG, and my car was stolen. So it was like, I had to, it was one of those moments where, you know how people say, you have one of those come to Jesus moments.
Okay, let me pause you for a second here. God bless you. The minute you steal my car, I'm out the door.
It's like, I don't know if I want to do this no more.
I don't have enough passion. You get my car stolen. That's insane.
And the irony was, I still was able to, you know, get to school and whatnot, and I was docked for that hour and a half pay for
for when your car was stolen?
Right. But we have moments like that. My mentor, his name is Guillermo Cabrera, he calls it builds character.
Mm-hmm.
Those character building moments.
Mm-hmm.
And so they got new administration there that were brought in to kind of change the school up, and it went up from there.
Okay, good.
And so I worked really hard with that group if they were in the fourth grade. And let me tell you, I was at houses and knocking on doors and talking with parents and giving them the eye.
Like straight out of Lean on Me?
Yes, straight out of Lean on Me.
That's what's up.
You could hear me down the hallways, basically. Yeah. And I mean, I didn't have a lot of resources within the classroom. It was basically, I started January 2010. And it's like, okay, I don't know where these kids are at learning-wise. I don't know lesson-wise, anything. So it started from scratch. And then you have these state assessments that come up. So it's like, how do I prep kids for state assessments that I'm just trying to figure it out myself?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, when you're in education, as you all will know in your jobs, it's about networking. It's about when you cross paths with great educators, you get resources.
Mm-hmm.
And I started calling on some of those resources and bringing them to the school and asking for help. And, you know, that finished that year and those kids' scores were through the roof.
Wow.
And
good.
The administration allowed me to handpick my class for the next year. And I picked another far below basic and basic group.
Wow.
That's what's up.
Yeah, I picked the kids that
nobody really wanted.
Mm-hmm. And those kids, most of them are prospering now. They're in the 9th and 10th grades.
That's awesome.
So I still keep in contact with mothers. I was on the phone with a mother the other day who is struggling to find a high school for her son who was in my class because, as you can imagine, you know, I'm not too familiar with when you get further south of San Diego. I'm in North County. But when you're in urban areas, quality schools with passionate people and resources are hard to come by.
Yeah, you ain't got to sugarcoat it. Say it like it is.
They're hard to come by. I'm just going to tell it like it is.
Yeah.
And it just breaks my heart that, you know, all these years later, and it's not just a California problem. You can Google, you can go on any
news. It's a nationwide problem.
It's a nationwide problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nationwide problem. And it goes back decades. Mm. And it's like, when are we going to come to the point where schools and urban communities are, first of all, let's talk about the edifices. They're just in deplorable condition, a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they need to be restructured. We are in this age of technology where some schools don't even have the capacity to have kids host having iPads or whatever technology. Mm-hmm. So they have to be retrofitted for technology and all this other thing. So that's kind of where I started to want to be an advocate for
education.
For the education and those, as we quote unquote that term, at-risk students and those parents, because like you said before, those are the parents who, you know, they're trying to keep their head above water and get themselves together, and they're entrusting that the school or the school district is doing everything possible to make sure that their children are safe, but and are learning.
Yeah.
But it almost, you know, no pun intended, it takes a village. Yeah.
No, it does.
It takes a village.
And that's the name.
It does. So
you got to be responsible, I hate to say it, for more than just your children nowadays.
Yeah.
If you can pull an extra one in and help them, if you just help one kid, you've changed one kid's life.
That's it.
And go with it.
That's it.
Yeah.
And I always tell people when I meet people who are becoming teachers for the first time, and I say, you know what? You have to be ready to go out of the box and do more than just the minimum. You can't, because oftentimes I was teaching more than just the kids in my class. Like I was telling your wife earlier, I recently went to a quinceañera of one of my students. I had her at fourth and fifth grade. Now she's 15. There was about 20 kids there from the school where I taught. Most of them were not in my class, but they all were hugging me because I was that teacher who, I don't care whose class you were in, who your teachers were, who your parents were, why are you not up here and the bell rang 5 minutes ago? Why are you, your shirt is revealing? Pull those pants up. Where's your backpack? Give me this word. Use it in context. That was me with kids, you know, because we have to do that as teachers.
Yes.
You have to be a teacher and a parent in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't realize it. You know, the masses think, oh, it was just teaching. And you, oh, shoot, you get off in the summers. You need those 4 or 5 weeks just to get your mind right there, recharge.
Yeah.
And if you have families at home, it's not really a break.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But or kids at home, for that matter.
It's you know, it's almost, you know how they have those shows where they're popular and everybody watches them, but when they do the behind the scenes, people are like, wow, that's all of that to make one cartoon scene? They need to do a behind the scenes of a teacher.
Yeah. Because all we see is the kids coming in and it's screwed up, and all of a sudden the kid is passing high school and they're heading off to college.
Right.
We don't see the long hours after the bell has rung, and you're sitting there with this kid trying to help him read.
Or the grading papers at home.
Right.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Right. That's another thing. I have a friend that's a teacher. She's very honest on Facebook about how she takes her work home and she grades papers at home. It makes no sense, she says, because she has all this work. She has 4 or 5 classes.
Ugh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And she has 20 plus students each class. She has to grade these kids' work. Mm-hmm. She cares about her kids.
Mm-hmm.
So she takes it home and she takes care of it. And that's just how it is.
I mean, you have to. Like when you're on a job and you're evaluated and your boss provides feedback to you, you kind of have to be aware of if there's any issues with your performance or if you are on the right path. And if you don't take that time with your students, then, you know, it's all for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have an abundance of students, trying to balance that where you can, you know, make sure everybody feels important and everybody's needs are met. Because let's think about it. Whatever grade you teach, you're the person at the head of the room, and you're in a room full of students that come from different economic statuses. They live in different communities. Their family makeups may be different. They may be foster youth, kinship youth, people who are being raised by relatives that are not their parents.
Mm-hmm.
They may be, you know, I can recall a time when I had, I was testing kids, and some of the kids were falling asleep in the test. And I wanted desperately to give them time to retake it. And And I wondered, why were these kids falling asleep in class? Because they were living in an apartment building, and the previous night they had a shooting, and it was yellow tape, and they couldn't get in home until after midnight. And then here they are taking the state assessment that we are grading them and evaluating right. them and the school on the next day,
right.
which we don't take into all those things
into
consideration, you know?
You know, can we talk for a split second about the state assessment? And here's my issue, and I'm not a teacher, and I'm going to preface my statement with, I am not a teacher. So you can hate me, you can email me, you can Facebook me, you can do whatever, but I'm not a teacher, so I can say whatever the hell I want to say, right? I hate the state assessments. I hate the state assessments. I feel like the state assessments are keeping our kids, I think they're stifling in teachers. I feel like these teachers are not able to be creative. They're not able to be innovative because they are forced to have to teach to this test. Mm-hmm. And I believe that teachers are only teaching to this test, right?
I agree.
Like, there are kids who probably could go beyond what the tests, mm-hmm. you know, they're at levels mm-hmm. where they could probably be taught beyond the test, you know? And then there are kids who probably are barely making it to be taught to the test. But I feel like the state assessment test, it kind of...
It boxes them in.
It boxes mm-hmm. them into, mm-hmm. you know, a box.
Mm-hmm.
And it bothers me this... I know the need for them because they need to be able to measure, like, kid success. They need to be able to measure.
Right.
But I feel like it's a flawed system. Like, you can't
right.
measure a child's success. You can't say, like, in second grade, they're going to take this test to see how they perform on second grade when they came into second grade, they was at a kindergarten level.
Yes.
Like, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I feel like if you don't get to the root of the problem, the state assessment really doesn't measure anything. It only half measures, if it really measures accurately anyway.
Yes.
You know, so I feel like the problem is that maybe you should not do state assessments at the end of the year, but give me a pre-assessment at the beginning of the year so I can see where you are. So
give me a pre, give me a during, and give me an end.
You know what I mean? So that way I can, you know, as a teacher, then you can really see what work was done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you take a kid and in the first day of class, the first week of class, they take this test, you can see where they are. Now you have something to base on. Now you know where they are and what level. You know, and you as a teacher, you know how to build them up as the year goes on. So you know if little Johnny is reading at he's in second grade and he's reading at a kindergarten level, you know what you have to work with little Johnny on, you know? And if you know that little Timmy reads above, you know, a second grade level, then you know, okay.
Meeting those needs as well.
And that's a lot. And I'm going to be honest with mm-hmm. you. That is a lot to ask for a teacher.
Especially when you have... a bunch, you know, you have a class of different kids at different learning levels.
Yes.
And your points are valid, and that's kind of a hot topic across the country right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, you know, there's a lot of districts and the ones that I came from where they do that monitoring, the pre, the during. It's called progress monitoring. You're monitoring them like every 6 to 8 weeks just to with assessment
mm-hmm.
to see where they are so that if there is some decline or they're, you know, performing above a level, then you can kind of make adjustments
okay.
for that child along the way. I think the issue becomes, and this is the hot topic, you go on Twitter and you see, you know, teachers from places like Ohio, New York, where you have this progress monitoring, but then you have this state exam that's once a year at the end, towards the end of the year, that the kids are taking right now in California.
Yeah.
And it's designed to assess what they've learned from the year. I think that's when you kind of cross the line, or you're teetering, is that too much?
Yeah.
Because the test now is smarter balance, and the tests are now computer. So the pencil of paper last year was the first year that it went to computer. Now the state is, you know, they're compiling the data, but they're not, you know, previously, the state schools were given an API score. So the kids would take the test. They would take the California Standards test. And they would, the scores would come out sometime in the fall. And that would be your school's ranking. The score, I think, would be somewhere between 600 down to 1,000. And the higher your score, the better ranked your school was compared to schools that were
right.
similar in the state. So that system went away. Now they still have the API, but because they're in a new testing with the Common Core standards and the Smarter Balance test.
That was what I wanted to ask you about right. next. We're going to talk about some Common Core because I have a nephew and I saw that math. I was like, this is not math.
Yeah.
This is not math. This is somebody was looking to make some money and developed a new system that we now got to figure out, which has, from what I've seen, and I've just, you know, hop online and tried to Google a few things, it has no practical application whatsoever in real life to me. Because 1 + 1 = 2.
Right.
1 + 1 = 5.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just saying.
Absolutely. So you're not alone. You know, I'm currently, I'm school site council chair at, I have a 14-year-old at his school. School site council is the body at school that oversees the school's education plan and their budget and makes decisions accordingly. And the PTSA president. So in visiting schools and going to meetings at the district, a lot of people are, you have one people on the side of Common Core like, okay, let's do this. And then the other side like, no. And I think personally, now this is my opinion.
Yeah.
Mrs. Brown, the teacher. My opinion is when you introduce things without having fully equipped your teachers or your staff and train them to kind of, so that they can get their brains around it and absorb it, and then you just, you know, you give it to them to implement, then it becomes, you run into problems. Yeah. It's kind of like everybody standing in line for the next iPhone, and you, I can't wait, it looks new, but everybody knows don't get that first one because it always has glitches.
Yes.
Because they hurried up to get it out. And that's kind of what I'm seeing with this. And it's, in theory, it's good to where everybody, the idea is that they want kids to be on the common playing field. They want them to, this Common Core math is more inquiry based, and kids are working in groups to process the information and do, you know, critical thinking and reasoning versus, you know, here's the sheet, do these problems, and here's the formula, and et cetera. They're having to work these problems out as a group, as far as math is concerned, and articulate how did you come to this, how did you arrive at this answer?
Yeah.
So, but if you're in certain communities where there's a language arts deficiency or kids have literacy issues, then that's a whole nother, a whole nother can of worms.
Yes.
Like, this is going to be a problem. I can see this being a huge issue for urban schools or for schools who have
ESL. High ESL students.
That's
English language learners.
This is going to be a huge issue for kids who aren't already on the playing field. If your kid is not on the playing field to even get there, they're not going to even excel at this at all. You know what I mean? Because they're not even coming to the table in the right way in the first place. You know?
I see a lot, you know, there's kids that are struggling with it. I just think that, and the issue is the state hasn't formally adopted Common Core standards. I mean, they have Common Core standards, but it's like there's districts that have yet to adopt the curriculum. So
some curriculums are doing regular traditional math, algebra,
and the other ones are
geometry,
Common Core. Like, my son is in a class who, you know, half the kids are, they're all doing this Common Core math. However, I remember him coming home and I said, where's the book? Oh, we don't use the book. They're using an online math program from a approved curriculum out of New York. Okay, so I have to go online and
download your work
and look at the teacher's notes. And in theory, it's nice, but you kind of have to crawl before you walk. Where's the training? Where's the, I think it might've been a little too soon to kind of introduce something, and especially when you go from that, and then you go from, you have this new testing computer, the state has kind of taken a step back as grading these schools because they recognize a lot of schools don't even have computers for kids.
That's another issue right there.
To take the tests.
That's a whole other issue.
The kids
for me.
Not having computer skills. And I worked with kids last year, and they had to. It was like, okay, the kids are taking the computer test. Now everybody can text.
Mm-hmm.
But taking a test and typing and doing that, what is that? ASDFJHK.
Mm-hmm. Home roll.
Right.
Home roll.
That's a lot. The home roll.
Yes.
Oh my God, you just took me back.
Dude, we had to pass that class just to get out of high school,
right,
too.
Right. But that's a whole different thing than, you know,
mm-hmm. Or using your thumbs.
So, putting technology in the kids' hands, teaching them those computer skills, mm-hmm. building literacy skills. Yeah. I think we need to concentrate on, you know, now there's a new funding formula on how schools receive funding, and that is helping people, schools, districts who have been hemorrhaged with cuts,
mm-hmm.
to go back to normal spending limits, right. But you know, we have to bring back things like librarians, magnet programs at schools instead of relying on putting the burden on the teacher to, if you have kids who have magnet school potential in your class and you have kids who are English language learners and you have kids who may need, you know, after school, that's a lot to kind of
put on one teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But, schools that are excel in teacher collaboration and teacher professional development and have strong administration, those are the schools that do well and excel,
mm-hmm.
who have, and this is number one, and if those of you who listening, if you don't hear anything else, parent involvement.
Say it one more time.
Parent involvement.
There it is.
One of the things that I've done this last year, I have a young son that I've been off, is getting involved politically. School board meetings, they have different councils. We just had a bond measure that passed in our community to help with the buildings, the school, because mm-hmm. some of them are older. And a part of that bond measure is the school board has to elect members of the community, or members of the community can apply and be approved to help oversee how those monies are spent.
Mm.
Now, those are those things we don't know about.
Community
oversight. There you go. It's called the Community Oversight Committee. Those are the things we don't know. Anybody can apply to that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You, I, people, anyone. You don't need to have a college degree, high school. You're a parent or a member of the community.
And you care.
Get involved. Go apply on those boards. Go to those board meetings. Go talk to the teachers. There's school site council meetings are open to the community. You can speak. If you live in an area with a small district, like most of San Diego is,
mm-hmm.
you can interface with your superintendent and the district officials and kind of, you know, voice your concerns.
Mm-hmm.
Talk with other parents, you know. One of the things a lot of cultures do well in California is one person will know and then they'll go back and tell the other people.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I love this platform that you guys have provided. One person comes and then it's like, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And then they go tell the next person. That's how we know about stuff. We have to.
That's how we learn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whether you're a single mother, single father, or whatnot, if you can't go, ask a friend to go, ask somebody to go and just get the information so that you all collectively will be better informed
mm-hmm.
about the decision making that affects your child.
Yeah.
And please vote. Please vote. I know we vote for president, but when you have those interim elections, school board and school measures, please do that, because I know in San Diego County, and I know we're running out of time, but I know in San Diego County, especially in the urban areas, the school board demographic does not reflect the community. And I think that's a direct effect of...
A reflection of lack of voting.
Lack of voting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hugely important.
Or lack of parent and community involvement.
Involvement and knowledge. When we know better, we do better.
That's true.
When we know better, we do better.
That's true. So, Village, let's take a quick break. Pause for the cause, take a quick little break, and we're going to come back and discuss some more, because knowledge is knowledge, okay?
Knowledge is power. You got to know it.
That's it.
All right, Village, take a quick break. We're gone.
technique. Technique.
We are back. We are back. It's your man KJ with Lady J and our special guest. Now, the first segment, I'm not going to lie, what you said has some realness to us. And we were just talking off air here about charter programs. And I'm going to need you to go ahead and repeat everything you just said. I'm going to need you to do that because that was real talk, you know?
Well, before you go there, I want to do the piggyback of the precursor to charter schools. I think that there is a huge push. You said that you spoke to a parent the other day, and she was having a problem with trying to find an appropriate school for her child, appropriate high school for her child. Mm-hmm. So in San Diego, there's
an urban area,
mm-hmm. right? And so there's been a push. I think there was a push back in like the 90s where if you didn't have a school that was appropriate or what you felt was deemed good, then you could bus your child to another school in another district.
Well, in LA, they called that opportunity transfer. But when the budget cut hit, I don't know if a lot of districts still have that.
In San Diego here, you can still transfer your child to another school, but it's up to the school to say yes or no.
Well, that's
they
called,
have room.
That's called school of choice, and yes, every district has that. If your school of residence is a public improvement school, you're in PI status, then you are allowed to send your child to a neighboring school that has a higher API score, as we talked, academic performance index, or that is a better performing school than your home school is. Mm-hmm. But if they're full, then obviously
they can't accept you. So here's the problem I have with a couple of these issues. The issue I have is, if I am allowed to, every time something goes wrong in my neighborhood or community, if I'm allowed to say, you know what, I'll just send my kid to another school, when does that ever give my school, my home school, when do they fix themselves?
I'm so glad you said that.
When do they fix themselves? Because they don't. Because you know why? They don't fix themselves because I'm sending my child to another school.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Absolutely.
And here it is. If I live in a neighborhood where I'm renting, I don't pay taxes. I don't pay taxes on my home. So therefore, the funding that comes from So there's funding that comes from when you own your home. So a portion of your taxes goes to pay for the neighborhood school and the neighborhood parks and all that stuff, mm-hmm. right?
Like where we live, yeah. Right.
But however, if I live in an urban community, I don't pay taxes because I live in an apartment complex, mm-hmm. right? So instead, the owner of the apartment complex may pay taxes, and it may be, you know, like...
It's not going to be nearly as much as if
yeah. I own a hundred apartment condo. That's 100 families that could pay taxes if they own their own home. You know what I mean? And money that could be funded into this neighborhood school.
Right.
That's a whole nother different
topic.
But that's still, the schools are still a part of your community. Whether
yes.
you rent or own,
mm-hmm.
your children go to those schools
yeah.
and they shape your community.
Yes.
They shape your community.
Yes.
And I'm so glad you said that.
Because it just makes me wonder, like, and my child, and I'm transparent. Right,
mm-hmm.
So I'm transparent enough to say that I transfer my child out of my neighborhood school to another school. Not because the school was bad, but because the school that my child went to, they offered a program that wasn't offered at one of the my neighborhood school.
Mm-hmm.
My son goes to a dual language Spanish program,
right.
and it's not offered in another school. It's only offered in the school that he went to,
mm-hmm.
just because they were implementing the program, so it was kind of a pilot program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since then, next year, there'll be some new changes that go on or whatever. However, there are kids that live next door to me, live down, they transfer their kids all over the city.
Mm-hmm.
They don't go to our neighborhood school, and they own their home. You know what I mean? So it always has me thinking, like, when is this little school, my little neighborhood school going to get good enough so my kid can go?
So it reminds me of... you know, during this last election, one of my neighbors ran for school board and she won.
Mm-hmm.
She unseated the school board president.
Wow.
And so I remember I contacted her from a flyer she put on my door. And I said, hey, I'm your neighbor. I didn't know you were running. You know, what were you about? And so she came over and I asked her questions. And I wanted to know her background in education.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I live in a community. I have a 14-year-old and a 15-month-old. My 14-year-old goes to the public school. The public school by our house is a Title I school, meaning they have they receive federal funding because they have a large number of English language learners, students who qualify for free or reduced lunch,
okay.
Foster youth, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided that we were going to send him there, and I was going to put all my efforts into being involved to make sure that he has the best education in our neighborhood school.
Mm-hmm.
So as I'm interviewing this particular board member, I asked her background in education, because she said she was a teacher. Well, her education and her teaching experience has only been charter school.
Mm.
And her children go to the charter school. So the other schools in the community are urban. So my thoughts were, well, you are on a board of a school district and you oversee this is her area, you know, it's different city to city,
right.
but each school board trustee, they cover certain areas. She covers our schools where my son goes.
Right.
She doesn't even send her own children
into
the public school.
Mm-hmm.
And her response was, well, because the elementary school has a 40% literacy rate. And I said, well, what's your plan to change that?
Yes.
Because as you said, if we keep pulling our kids
mm-hmm.
out of these schools,
yeah.
then those schools will not get better. And I'm just going to go out there because we're keeping it real, right?
Yeah.
I remember sitting talking to a group of my students around the May Day, and everybody know that's the Immigration March Day.
Mm-hmm.
And I told them, you know, my students and I, we had a lot of real conversations about the world. I was one of those teachers that I took academics, well, I still am, academics and the world, and we put it together because that's how you make a well-rounded individual.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I told my students, and I'm going to preference this because I know people are going to be, there are countries that people are suffering horribly in a lot of other countries. We have it pretty good here. But I told my students, if everybody left their country for better schools, for better jobs, or et cetera, would that make their home countries improve?
Mm.
And they were like, oh, I never thought of that. Because and they come here for better education, and a lot of them, you know, go on to be great citizens in this country and
mm-hmm.
in our community. And you have some cultures that go back and to their home country and try to help. But like, I kind of, you know, kind of made a connection with that. And if everybody took their kids out of this public school and put them into the charter school, and let's be real, a lot of the charter schools are by lottery.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if you like my son is receives special ed services.
Mm-hmm.
He is in general ed class. He's in advanced classes, but he, you know, needs a little help because of a disability.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But that's one of the questions that they ask you when you put your name on this list to be in a lottery.
Yes.
Now, I have issue with that. Personally, I have issue with that.
Because what does that got to do with the lottery?
That has to do with the lottery.
You're picking
because
a kid.
People don't realize that a lot of charter schools do not have
special
ed services.
Yeah.
Or English language development services for students learning English if they're in an early level or beyond a certain level.
Yeah.
So, you know, sitting in meetings, we used to tell parents, if you want to send them to that school, you know they won't have the services for your child. So
no, that makes sense because my son is on an IEP and he's hard of hearing. And so I remember when we were looking for schools, we were looking to see if public schools is what we wanted, charter schools is what we wanted, even private schools, you know, because I feel like I work a couple of jobs if I got to send my kid to private school if that's the best school.
Right.
But I do distinctly remember talking to his speech and language person. I can't think of her name. I know her name, but I can't think of her title.
Mm-hmm.
Her audiologist, the school audiologist, she says, if you put him in a private school, he will not receive services mm-hmm. any longer. And I had to pull back and say, well, you know what? That can't be because mm-hmm. I need him to receive services from the school for his hearing issues.
Because a lot of the time, private schools don't have the resources to even assess a child to see if there's a need. They have to contact the school district, and then the school of residence is whose job it is to test the kid. I tested a kid last year who was a private school student, but his home school was where I worked.
Yeah.
But everybody came to the table and said, well, here are the services we have at the private school. Yeah. And, you know, and it was up to the parent to determine
to decide
what they want to do. But, you know, and don't get me wrong. There are some charter schools that are doing well.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
I
yeah.
mean, they're, you know, all over the country. But when you get into, when you're talking about, let's talk about what we were talking about off the air.
Mm-hmm.
There are some that, and it's becoming a trend, and you can go and look in any news articles. There's a lot of them coming up lately where when you get in certain communities where there's a class divide, where you have, like you said, rentals versus mm-hmm. homeowners, when you have a huge discrepancy in income levels,
mm-hmm.
kind of where I live. I'm not going to say where I live.
Mm-hmm.
But you have charter schools that people, a lot of, like in my neighborhood, a lot of the kids that go to the charter schools are families that are from that higher income level.
Mm-hmm.
So their kids don't go to the public schools.
They go to the charter
schools. And it's
schools.
Like, they only take so many classes, so they only take so many kids per year, which I think that's where you get involved with the board and whatnot to kind of voice your concerns that you want the charter schools demographically should reflect the community.
Mm-hmm.
Should yes. reflect the community.
Yes.
And so,
I mean, yeah, if you live in an urban area and most of your kids are
African American
or
Latino.
Look, I'm going to go ahead and say if most of your kids are Caucasian, I'm going to go ahead and say it. If they're Caucasian or Asian or something like that,
right.
and you live in a neighborhood where every kid is either Black or Latino,
then
where
a
are you getting these kids from?
That's a
right.
question. Yes.
Right.
Yes. Because they're definitely not
Absolutely.
Coming from, they're not the kids down the street.
Exactly. Especially
Absolutely.
When this kid lives across the street from this school.
Absolutely.
And he's having to go to school 4 or 5 miles away versus this charter school that is across the street
across
from his house.
Street.
That makes no sense to
and
me.
And you have the lottery system. I have issue with that because, where you know, my former colleagues and I, the thing was, you know, and this is just my opinion, charter schools do well because they have a different structure. They receive funds just like I do, depending on if it's a dependent or independent charter, but they have a different structure. They have a different curriculum. They have a little more flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
The parents are kind of encouraged, if not sometimes borderline mandated, to be more involved, to be more attentive, to be here. And it's the same parents and same kids that go to, that live in the neighborhood that you live in, that go to the neighborhood schools. And it's like, how well would your child do if they were at a school that, you know, there was only so many kids accepted per year, which meant a small environment? There is a lot of kids that will excel in these small learning environments.
Mm-hmm.
This former student I was telling you about earlier, he came from a charter middle school, and it was a small environment. And then the high schools were full, so she had to send him to a public high school. You're talking about from 800 to 3,000 students. That's a huge difference.
Yeah.
Insane.
That's a huge difference.
It's insane.
If you're, you know, we're to talk about, you know, what's going on in Black America with young Black men and young Latinos, mm-hmm. and some of them excel in smaller environments, mm-hmm. where
yes.
they can get that one-on-one attention, if they're, where they can be assessed,
yes.
and if they are X amount of grade levels behind, that gap can kind of, you know,
be more narrowed,
and they could have access to more resources.
Yes.
Because like in my neighborhood, there's two schools,
mm-hmm.
and this will blow your mind. I recently toured a school in my neighborhood. There's a high school and there's an elementary school opening up. It's only going to be grades 4-6.
Mm.
They're both lottery systems. So the high school is built on the top of a hill, floor-to-ceiling windows, one-to-one iPad. The elementary school, one-to-one iPad. They have, I mean, they have a state-of-the-art gym with a room with spin cycles. They have corridors and lounge furniture and commons cafeteria like we did in college. Charter school, public school, what do you think?
I'm hoping public school.
It's a public school, but it's a lottery.
Oh, see.
It's lottery. So the particular high school only takes 200 kids per grade per year, and that's it. So right now, the ninth grade, they just took first 200, 90 on the wait list. Who wouldn't want to go to a state-of-the-art campus with, you know, everyone gets an iPad. The elementary school, the same thing, lottery system, and it's just like...
Wow. You know what I'm sitting here thinking about? When it's almost like a correlation to sports and athletics as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
When you look better, I think you do better.
You do better.
And when you're in a crappy mm-hmm. situation, you do mm-hmm. what your environment kind of dictates. Mm-hmm. And I think that's all psychological.
All psychological. They can look out a window and see the Jets, mm-hmm. the gentleman, the serviceman practicing, you know, as the Jets go by. Just to get that fresh air and the program that they run. And I toured the campus and I kind of had a grim look, and my friend, because I belong to an ed group, and they were like, are you impressed? And I said, I have mixed feelings, because I'm thinking about all the kids
who don't get this,
who won't be able to get in this. And I chose not to put my son in the lottery, because it's like, I wanted to make our public high school work.
Yeah.
By getting involved and doing my part, because if I talk the talk, I have to walk the walk.
And you know what? I think that's exactly it. That is it. Like, if you are going to make your school better, you have to be involved.
You have to.
You know? And I'm be the one to say, like, I haven't been involved in my son's school, but I thought about it. And I did think about it. I thought about it because I was like, I think I want to get on the PTA. I'm not on the PTA. I think I want to do it. But then they're going to be, this is his last year at that school, and then they're going to open up a language academy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, I think I'm going to wait and go on the new year and be involved in a language academy, just because we won't be at the school any longer. If we were going to stay here at this school, then I would definitely join the PTA and get involved.
But being involved doesn't always mean you got to show up and do the, you know, you can take stuff home. You can do letter writing to help the school raise funds. There's a lot of things you can do. I'm getting ready to volunteer to help a teacher, I think 6th or 7th grade, with some of the kids who are struggling with reading. Push my baby in the stroller in the classroom and sit in there and read with some of those kids.
So getting involved doesn't necessarily mean PTA.
PTA, and or you got to come to meetings, or, you know.
You know, that's great, because I think that some of our parents probably would like to get involved, but they can't make it to the PTA because they work, you know, two jobs or something.
Yeah, they're stuck in this mindset that PTA is the best way to help.
And right.
There's many other ways to help.
There's many other ways. Like the school where my son goes, great administration. They have coffee with the principal where, you know, he talks about what's going on with the school for that week or that month, that trimester. The librarian, does literacy drives and programs mm-hmm. and rewards kids and, you know, school site council in making decisions about funding. I talked about these schools that have these iPads and whatnot. You get on school site council.
Amazing. Like
amazing.
An iPad.
Oh, they have a conference room that looks like the UN U-shape where they have screens and drop-down mics to interface with schools globally.
Yeah.
But I feel only, so cheated.
But this is only just for one group of kids.
But this is for one group of kids.
That,
and
that's
so
it's
great for those kids and their families, but this is where we come in making sure that it, you know, this is kind of what the current Congress wants in the last administration, that whole
the global
trickle
and STEM
up, that, you know, if you know, the cream, let it come down to the bottom.
The trickle down effect.
Yeah. Well, how about let's supply these schools with iPads, other schools. Let's retrofit their buildings. Let's put air conditioning in the classrooms. Let's, you know, get those LCD projectors and whatever the technology that's out there. Let's get it into these kids' hands, because a lot of our kids, especially kids of color, do well with multi ways of learning with, you know, online and moving around and getting outside of the environment and using all of those tools, just like all of the stuff that we have right here in front of us, teaching a kid in the third grade how to work all this, that whole coding movement, teaching kids how to code. So by the time they're in high school, they're making apps.
Yeah.
They're making apps. But
we're trying to get our oldest into that program too.
It's a definite necessity. And it's like, you know, one of the jobs that our council is doing is we're making sure, you know, we have 1,100 kids. We don't have the funds to buy every kid an iPad.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can get half the school and kind of get a rotation system going on, mm-hmm. and each year as the funds become available, do that.
By the time, in about 4 or 5 years, everyone will have an
everyone
iPad.
Everyone would do that. Hopefully sooner.
Yeah.
But this is where that another thing that's going on across the country besides the assessment, where big businesses are coming in. Companies like Bill Gates Foundation and mm-hmm. Microsoft and Apple and all these other companies, and you know, they can outfit a whole school
and write it off on their taxes.
And it's nothing for them.
And write it off on their taxes like it's nothing.
You know?
Yeah. You know, I think we're always running out of time. We never have enough time to do this type of stuff.
Right.
You know, but I think that the message that I heard, some take home that I heard was parents get involved.
Yes.
It doesn't matter. Just call your kids' teachers and see what you can do to get involved. That could be something simple as, you know, cutting out some shapes if your kid is in kindergarten, or, you know, helping your child. I don't know. You can do anything. You can come and help organize the kids, the library. In the classroom, that would be something that can relieve some stress off of your teacher.
Absolutely.
You know, because teachers need all the help that they can get. I personally believe that every teacher needs a TA. You know, I think that every teacher needs an intern to come in and be like, look, let me figure out how I can help.
I have said that.
You know,
every teacher needs a TA and an intern.
Yes.
They need, you need that.
I honestly don't understand why it couldn't happen. Like, if you know coming into college that you want to be a teacher, I feel like it should be a requirement in one of these classes that you take is you find yourself a school to become a part of, and you have to be a TA. Like, for a semester, you have to be a TA.
You have to do student teaching towards the end, but that's a valid point to do it through, because in doing that, you may find out that's not for you.
Yes. You may. I have a friend of mine who's a nurse now. He got his bachelor's in secondary education. He said he was in the classroom during that class, he said he was in the classroom, and then he realized that he didn't want to be a teacher. But it wasn't until the tail end of his semester, tail end of college, that he realized that I got this and I don't ever want
to
do this.
But hats off to him for recognizing that and moving on to another thing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who 10, 20 years in the game and they haven't come to that realization.
Yeah, the lemon teachers.
Because, not even that, but think about it. You spend all this money on school.
Absolutely.
Like, school ain't free.
I'm going to be real with you. 2 teaching credentials and a master's, $85,000.
Look at this. You know what I mean? $85,000.
$507 a month.
Think my kids are beaten.
It would be a cold day if I went and spent $85,000 for a degree, for some credentials, and not do it.
I tell you what, though, I wouldn't change my experiences or this journey for
as
the
long
world,
as you're happy. That's what you got to do. Like, if you're happy with what you're doing, keep going. Yeah. I tell people that.
I wanted to say, just in closing, Camila, is there anything that you could tell, tidbits? Give us words of encouragement for our teachers or for our parents or something that we can take home. What's the take home from this whole podcast?
I would say for parents, get involved. Start that dialogue with your child's teachers, with the administration. And if you're not comfortable with them, get involved to kind of see what you can do to change that. If you are comfortable with them, do things to, you know, celebrate them and encourage them. You keep that dialogue open and they will be advocates for your child. Mm. For teachers, you know, it's a thankless job, teaching. Mm. And it's, you have to fight, and we go through struggles like no other career path in this country or in this, you know. But what I would say to teachers is just to continue to improve yourself. Mm-hmm. The tech, you know, get involved. Go on Twitter. Go on Facebook. Look at the get those apps. You know, transition. Don't be so stuck in your practices that you get lost in the current trends. Mm-hmm. Get out there and see how incorporating iPads and your technology. Even if you just get an iPad yourself and work it out. You know. Always look for ways to improve, you know, your teaching practices and your professional development, and just be encouraged. You know, there's a lot of things that behind the scenes people don't realize that teachers go through, whether you're a new teacher, a 5-year teacher, a 10-year teacher, et cetera. Just be encouraged and know that you are appreciated by individuals like ourselves, and there's a lot of us out there, and maybe we need to do a better job in communicating that to our
teachers and letting them know, like, hey, you're going through, we're going through with you, and I need you to know, thank you,
and let's build a village and take care of these kids.
Take care of it. Yeah, I agree. Okay, Lady J.
Thank you for coming on and being part of the show.
Miss Camila Brown, we appreciate it. Like, this is.
Thank you.
Amazing. Because I'm all about it now. Like, I have kids now. It's a little different. I look at education a little different.
Yes.
So before, I didn't care. They call me, do you vote for this measure? No, I don't care. Don't call me no more. But now I'm like, wait, tell me about it first. So, Village, as usual, folks, we thank you for listening. We love you. God bless you. Have a great night. Go on.
Are you in the area of Melbourne, Florida? Are you in need of an excellent dog or cat groomer that loves your four-legged family as much as you do? Well, at Heavenly Touch Dog and Cat Grooming, we love each other just as we love your pets. Family-owned and run, with perfection as our goal. If you would like to book an appointment, please call us at 321-622-6963. Email us at heavenlytouchdogandcatgrooming@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook at Heavenly Touch Dog and Cat Grooming, and check out our photo gallery of our adorable, satisfied customers. Come visit us in person, 2260 Sarno Road, Melbourne, Florida, 32935. Visit our website for the most current pet-friendly specials, www.heavenlytouch.vpweb.com. With a variety of services to choose from, we are sure you'll be happy working with us. We know your pet will want to come back for another Heavenly Touch.